From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Forensic evidence is a mainstay on television crime shows and in real-life courtrooms. Hair sampling, bite marks, handwriting analysis, burn patterns. But mounting questions about the reliability of a lot of forensic evidence have now prompted the FBI to launch a big review of over 2,000 convictions and to publicly concede that many of their forensic techniques may not have been sound. It's just the latest in a series of moves reshaping how the American justice system handles the kind of forensic evidence that has put a lot of people in prison. This hour, On Point, forensic evidence itself on trial. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What if a whole lot of that sciencey sounding stuff is a lot of hooey? If NCIS is a pipe dream, what do we do in real life? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. On NCIS, it all sounds so easy. The fibers, the residues, the cigar smoke.
The killer picked up this fiber, took it to work, had it in his car, carried it to the woods. There has to be some sign of that guy on this fiber.
Not if he wore gloves.
Maybe the gloves have a different residue than NCIS gloves. Maybe he smokes a cigar. Maybe there's cigar residue on the fiber.
You're testing for cigar smoke?
And a whole lot more. Joining us first today from Centerville, Massachusetts, is Jack Nickus, national reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He's been following all this. Jack, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Why is the FBI reviewing all these cases?
Well, for years, as you pointed out, there have been questions from forensic scientists and defense attorneys over the true science behind many of these forensic disciplines. You know, a lot of crime show staples like, you know, bite marks, ballistics evidence, handwriting analysis, burn patterns, among many others. And in the 1990s, the Department of Justice Inspector General did a investigation into some shoddy practices that were the reports of over at FBI crime labs. And they looked at hair analysis. And specifically, they found over basically a 10-year review that there were some serious problems in FBI experts overstating the value of this hair analysis. And before the advent of DNA in about the year 2000, basically at many crime scenes, FBI experts would take a hair from a crime scene and compare it visually under a microscope to a hair from a suspect. And,
yeah.
And based on the two hairs, they would draw conclusions like, this hair, to the exclusion of all other hairs in the world, came from that suspect.
Right.
And these were used in trials, but unfortunately, there's no scientific basis for that sort of conclusion. So the FBI found that there were problems, and they reported these problems to prosecutors. But what never happened was these findings were never released to defense attorneys and to the defendants. So these findings never came to light, essentially. Now, last year, in some terrific reporting by the Washington Post and Spencer Hsu there, he revealed this, and the FBI, under pressure, then opened up an unprecedented sweeping review of thousands of convictions that were based off this flawed hair analysis. Now, last week, they announced that in their first review of the first 15,000 convictions, in 2,100 of those cases, FBI experts made a positive association between the hairs found at crime scenes and the hairs of suspects, and including 27 of those cases are death penalty cases. Now the FBI and the Innocence Project are undergoing a deeper review of those cases to see if FBI experts erred in their testimony.
So in those 27 death penalty cases in 2,000-plus that weren't death penalty, you're saying they found cause to confirm the connection, or they found cause for to question it?
Well, basically what they found was that our FBI experts, and we knew over this period from 1985 and 1999, they were systematically overstating the value of their conclusions in this hair analysis. We found in 2,100 cases, they went to trial and said, that hair from the crime scene is very much like, if not definitely from, this suspect. And they didn't have the scientific basis to say that. So now there's going to be a deeper review of these more than 2,000 cases to find out if they really did overstate the value and to what degree, and at that point, that information will be provided to defense attorneys for a full-scale sort of appellate challenge.
And that's just one strand of forensic evidence, and just during one period from 1985 to 99, and of course the FBI, what, does only a small percentage of the law enforcement in this country. You know, you go to state and local, and you've got a lot more cases.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, many critics of these forensic science said this is only the tip of the iceberg. This is exactly, it's only one forensic discipline, and it really is only the FBI laboratory that they're looking at. And what's interesting is these FBI experts that have been shown to have overstated the value of this analysis, they were the ones who went out and trained all the state and local crime lab directors and crime lab analysts. And so what we've really seen is it seems to be more of a systemic problem that is going to require a deeper review. So actually, in an unprecedented move this spring, the national board that accredits state and local crime labs, they sent out a memo and basically instructed all the crime lab directors from across the country to say, hey, listen, in light of this FBI review, you need to look at your own practices over this period and see if any of our cases warrants their own review.
This is kind of mind-boggling, the way you describe it. We could have, I don't know how many people sitting in jail in prison in this country, convicted in whole or part on the basis of forensic evidence that the FBI itself is now kind of backing away from?
Right. I mean, this is a major, it could be a very major problem and potential scandal here. And the estimates are scary. It could be in the thousands, certainly.
And if we take it on out, I mean, some of these things are still hot right now. You mentioned what I think a case in New York going on now where the issue of bite marks, for example, is front and center.
Right. So what's fortunate is, you know, there's been a lot of pressure over these forensic disciplines for many years. And after decades of inaction, for the most part, by the criminal justice system and law enforcement and prosecutors, et cetera, we've now seen over the past year, really, a sea change. There's been many cases, court decisions and policy changes that have begun to acknowledge, admit problems, and try to begin the change here. So one case that a lot of advocates and critics alike are watching very closely is a murder case in Manhattan where, you know, in many of these cases, there are scientific standards for courtrooms. So these forensic disciplines defense attorneys can challenge and say, these don't meet the scientific standards of this court.
Yeah.
And in almost all cases, though, in the past, judges have basically dismissed those challenges with a wave of the hand and basically citing past precedent. Other courts have approved these. We're going to let them through. But because of the pressure on this, especially bite marks, which has been one of the most challenged forensic disciplines of them all, this murder case in Manhattan, the judge last year made an unprecedented move in calling a full hearing. It's the first full hearing to the challenge to the scientific admissibility of bite marks. And so the sort of best actors from both sides came out and made their case for why bite marks should be admitted in the courtroom, and the judge is expected to make his ruling in September, and that could be a very big decision. And maybe if he rules that these bite marks aren't admissible, then we may be seeing much fewer of these types of forensic disciplines in the courtroom in the future.
But it's not just hair comparisons and bite marks. I mean, there's another case you cite here, Mississippi Supreme Court staying an execution, an arson, just hours before it was scheduled, after the Justice Department came down admitting that FBI experts erred in their testimony on evidence, forensic evidence around arson.
Well, that case actually was a murder case. It was an arson, but arson, you are correct, is another one of the very criticized and disputable forensic disciplines and arson investigations. But this Mississippi case also happened in the past year and is another unprecedented case because you have the Department of Justice admitting FBI experts erred in their testimony. And specifically, this was somewhat part of that larger hair analysis, but when they went back and reviewed this case as part of the hair analysis review, they found, well, our FBI expert not only overstated the value of the hair comparison, but they also overstated the value of their ballistics testimony. And basically what they did, another forensic discipline that's been challenged is called tool mark analysis. And it's basically, we can determine from the mark on your body or the suspect, that's a mark from a tool, and we can determine what tool it came from, whether it be a screwdriver that was used in a murder, or actually tool marks could be markings on a bullet, and we can determine that bullet came from that gun. And that's something you see in CSI all the time.
All the time.
But in reality, it's a discipline that has not been scientifically tested and has been proven to be unreliable. And in this case, the FBI experts testified that the bullet used in the murder definitively came from a gun that was connected to this suspect, Willie Manning, in Mississippi. So this man was set to die by lethal injection in May, and just days before his execution was scheduled, the Department of Justice sent three separate letters, and including the lab reports, to the prosecutors in the case, saying, listen, our FBI experts overstated their value. You need to hold off for a second. And the Mississippi Supreme Court, literally hours before this man was set to die, they stayed the execution, and he is now in somewhat legal limbo, and that's going to be playing out over the next several months.
Jack, this is all kind of mind-blowing. After all the decades in which this was just the way of doing things, this kind of forensic evidence, now we've got this sea change. You report just in the last year, Justice Department establishing a National Commission on Forensic Science to set guidelines for forensic disciplines. Incredible, those haven't been there already.
Right.
I mean, DNA has come on strong. I suppose people will use that a lot more now. But this has just been the way business was done in American justice for a long, long time. What's it mean to have this deep reconsideration of the efficacy of these techniques?
Well, it's, it is a major sort of problem that needs to be reviewed, that some critics say. You know, and not only are we talking about potentially thousands of people who were convicted using this erroneous evidence, but
and not just potentially. You and others cite cases where it has become clear
for sure
now by DNA evidence that they were falsely convicted by forensic evidence.
Absolutely, there are many exonerations, and some statistics quickly to give you a sense of how wide this can be. You know, in terms of the exonerations we've seen over the past decade, there have been 416 cases where the defendants have been exonerated in homicide cases, and in 23% of those cases. False or misleading forensic evidence, which is part of it. In sexual assault cases, we've seen 203 exonerations, and in 37% of those cases, false or misleading forensic evidence was a factor.
And some of these people in prison for a long, long time on the basis of that evidence. Jack Nickus with the Wall Street Journal. Terrific of you to join us. Really grateful for it. Thanks so much for being here, Jack.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about deep second thoughts on the accuracy of forensic evidence. The FBI now reviewing thousands of cases where it's nothing like as slam dunk as CSI, where thousands may have been wrongly convicted, looking at what works, what often doesn't, and what we do now. We've seen it again and again, in TV shows. It works. CSI, 2003.
Interesting striations.
I fired this projectile out of a standard 22, like the one they used on Gloria.
Single set of striations.
So you have one set of striations from the barrel, another set from the silencer, and then finally the washer fragments to silence any escaping sound.
Did you run these bullets through IBIS?
I did. And the first set of striations matches an unsolved 4-year-old armed robbery in Yulita.
It's also clear in TV fiction, but this is in real life as well, the real world where people really go to prison. Here's a little bit. It's not just ballistics. Here's from June 2011 in the Casey Anthony trial. Forensic scientist Arpad Vaus claimed that through odor analysis, he was detecting human composition taken from air samples. He said even before he tested the air, he knew it was the smell of human decomposition.
I recognize this human decomposition odor. I essentially jumped back a foot or two, and the odor was extremely overwhelmingly strong.
Consequences for real people, very, very severe. Levon Brooks served 16 years in a Mississippi prison for the rape and murder of a 3-year-old girl. A forensic dentist, Dr. Michael West, testified teeth marks found on the girl matched his. DNA evidence exonerated Brooks. He was freed in 08. He talked with NPR in 2011.
They ran a dental impression on me, so that's what got me to wondering then. Is they trying to set me up? They charged me with capital murder. I couldn't even believe that.
He sat in prison for a long time. Many still there. 800-423-8255 is our number. We're looking at forensic evidence and what we can believe there. With us right now from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Barry Logan. He's president of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences. Barry Logan, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
The FBI's moves seem to indicate that something's gone wrong, or maybe it always was wrong. What's happening here, Barry?
Well, specifically with respect to hair testing, that's a technique that developed probably 30, 40 years ago. And the standards in forensic science were very different then. The way that we design methods, the way that we validate them and test them before they're applied to casework, that's very different today from what it looked like in the past. So some of the limitations that have been identified with the way that those tests have been performed and the way that scientists in the past or examiners in the past were testifying about the results were brought to the light by people who are practicing forensic science today under the standards that we practice today. Before a new technology would be put into place today, it would have to go through a rigorous process of validation to be sure that it's not going to give false positive results, so we know what the limitations of the test are before it's applied to casework. But we are living with the legacy of some techniques from the past that haven't gone through that, and hair examination is one example.
We've heard a lot about, over the years recently, about the CSI effect, that Americans sit around watching these shows where the forensic evidence is so decisive. And then they end up on juries, and they expect to see forensic evidence, and they put an awful lot of faith in it. Have we overall, as our system, swung too far in the direction of here's the forensic evidence, so that's got to be your conclusion?
No, I don't think so. Forensic evidence is a critically important part of many, many criminal trials, and there are, within the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, 11 different disciplines. The science behind forensic science was scrutinized about 5 years ago in a report by the National Academy of Sciences, who brought to light some of their concerns about some branches or some disciplines or tests within the profession. But they highlighted kinds of testing like DNA analysis, toxicology testing, controlled substance analysis as techniques and sound science that were based on strategies and procedures that are used in industry and medicine, in environmental testing.
But what about all the old standbys, burn patterns and bite marks and ballistics we were just hearing called into question?
Well, these constitute a very small proportion of the types of cases where that type of evidence would be presented in court.
Now they do. Here, for many years, weren't they standbys?
Sure, yes. I mean, at the time that hair analysis or attempts to identify people based on their hair, at the time that technology was used, it was prior to the introduction of DNA testing. When DNA testing was developed and validated back around 2000, laboratories stopped using hair for the purposes of identification. So a lot of the cases that your first guest discussed that are now being reviewed, these are older cases, and we now have better technology to address whether a miscarriage was done in those cases.
Older cases, but not so old, and with real-world consequences. Here's a bit of tape. Cameron Todd Willingham was executed in Texas in 2004 for the murder of his three young children by arson. Forensic scientists and arson experts claimed at the time there was proof of arson caused by an accelerant. The science has since been called into question. Here's Barry Scheck, co-director of the Innocence Project, discussing Willingham's case in front of the Texas Forensic Science Commission in 2010.
It became clear to the Texas Fire Marshal's Office that when they adopted 921, that the old method, which was scientifically invalid, where they were making inferences that an accelerant was there based on scouring and alligatoring and spyglass and all the other things that have been discredited, they had an obligation to go back and notify prosecutors that they could no longer stand behind the testimony.
They did not do that. Cameron Todd Willingham executed. Peter Neufeld joins us now from Washington. He is co-director as well of the Innocence Project, a nonprofit that tries to help innocent people wrongly imprisoned. In 1995, 2000, served on the New York State Commission on Forensic Science, co-author of Actual Innocence. Peter Neufeld, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for inviting me.
What do you make of this big FBI review of forensic evidence?
Well, actually, we and I in particular worked with the FBI on coming up with this review. The FBI really should be applauded because what they're saying is, you know what? We had it wrong, and we had it wrong for a couple of decades, and we have a duty to correct it. And that's fundamentally different than the way that forensic science dealt with these kinds of problems in the past. In the old days, folks would circle the wagons and resist any kind of criticism. But now the FBI is saying, no, that's not the way to be. We're going to identify all these problems. We're going to notify all the people who are affected by them. And if possible, we're going to try and remediate them. That's why they're offering free DNA testing.
And no longer notifying just the prosecutors, but also the defense, who can raise it on behalf of those now imprisoned.
Well, that's right. For a long time, crime labs would think that their only customer was the law enforcement agency or DA's office that submitted the evidence. But slowly, folks are coming around to the reality that all these state and federal crime laboratories, the true customer is the criminal justice system. The defendants, the defense lawyers, the judges, the civilian population. And so they realize that in the interest of transparency, the FBI will be notifying all the defendants and defense lawyers as well. And that's unprecedented.
Now, that's just the FBI. And, of course, they're a small percentage compared to the law enforcement work done at the state and local level. If they've got 2,000 cases under review, what does that say, since a lot of other people use these techniques for a long time, about the potential total number of cases that, by rights, maybe ought to be reviewed?
Oh, I think that, in fact, actually Barry Logan has firsthand experience with that phenomena with a hair examiner who ran the state laboratory in Montana, who was trained by the FBI and basically defended himself, saying, they're the ones who taught me to use these scientifically invalid numbers and probabilities when describing the significance of the hair evidence. It turns out that this is not one bad apple or outlier, that many or most of the FBI agents were doing it wrongly, and they were training state and local hair examiners all over the United States to provide scientifically invalid testimony. And frankly, it's not fair to simply say this is limited to hair and older discipline. The truth of the matter is that in 2009, the National Academy of Science said quite explicitly that most of these pattern disciplines and impression disciplines, which are used all the time now, whether it's fingerprints, ballistics, bite marks, tire marks, all of them suffer from the same problem that the probabilistic estimates and frequencies they would talk about had never been scientifically validated, still haven't been scientifically validated, but nevertheless, people have been making these outrageous statements in courts of law to the detriment of truth.
A bunch of questions arise here. Number one, is it just DNA coming along, Barry Logan, with its, I guess, higher rate of accuracy that has made old techniques look kind of crummy by comparison? Is that what's brought a lot of this to light, Barry?
That was maybe part of the process, but I think, as in any scientific discipline, as science and technology has improved and as practitioners are more pay more attention to the validation of their techniques, forensic scientists themselves started to recognize the limitations of some of these older procedures and have stopped using them in their laboratories. With respect to some of the other pattern evidence techniques, it's true that they're practiced by a much smaller cadre of people with specific expertise.
Does that mean bite marks, ballistics, cases, and all that? That when you say pattern?
Oh, so we're talking the kinds of evidence you're talking about, bite marks, ballistics, bullet comparisons, mm-hmm. Hair comparisons. These would be examples of pattern evidence.
Mm-hmm. And those, Peter, Barry suggests now used by a relatively small number of experts and maybe a small number of cases.
Well, that's not really fair for a couple of reasons. And Barry, by the way, has a lot of experience with this.
Sure.
And I think he would agree that certainly crime laboratories, you do more testing involving bench chemistry for the presence of controlled substances than any other forensic discipline. But that's not the forensic discipline they use in solving murder cases or murder cases, sexual assault cases. The disciplines sure. they use in those kinds of violent crimes are the fingerprints, ballistics, tire marks, bite marks, hair, things like that. I mean, all those impressions and patterns play an important role. And unfortunately, according to most crime laboratory directors, DNA is present in only a small minority of even violent crime. And so the crime laboratories are forced to resort to many of these older disciplines, which have never been scientifically validated. You know, the reason that the NAS report knocked all these different disciplines, and this was scientists knocking them just a few years ago, is because unlike controlled substances, unlike toxicology, unlike DNA, which had applications in medicine and other applied sciences before they were used in criminal justice, these other disciplines did not. They were developed by law enforcement people for law enforcement. And so the kind of scientific rigor that other sciences are used to, like DNA, were not brought to bear in the development or implementation in a court of law of all these other disciplines. And it's gotten to crisis proportions.
Of course.
And it's great that the FBI recognizes it.
Yeah, they're being very frank about it right now. I mean, we know where I'm sitting in Massachusetts, we know very well that even controlled substances lab work can be deeply to go off the rails. It did here, thousands and thousands of cases brought into question because of that. But I'm wondering, as I hear all this, Peter, whether our system even works without these things. I mean, if so many convictions have depended in no small part on this kind of evidence, do we even know how to do? There may be a significant wrong conviction rate here, but do we even know how to do justice in this country without this kind of evidence that's now being called into question?
Well, you know, justice in the United States is great, but not perfect. And frankly, I think for too long we simply paraded around bragging about how we were better than everybody else without paying enough attention to how we failed and how we were vulnerable. And I think you're right. It's the great number of DNA exonerations which brought to light that in about half these cases, faulty forensic science played a role in convicting innocent people that now has everybody thinking about these issues quite seriously.
Let me go to Jim in Nashville, Tennessee. Jim, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. And hi, Peter. Thanks for all the good work you guys do at Innocence Project. I support you as regularly as I can, and if I ever win the Powerball, you're going to be well-funded. But the point I wanted to bring up is that a lot of the proliferation of bad forensic science, I think, comes from prosecutorial overzealousness and the disparity of resources between prosecution and defense oftentimes, where the prosecution can and often does go shopping for alleged forensic experts who fit their predisposition, who have the answers that they want the trial jury to hear.
No question, that's happened again and again. I mean, Barry Logan, we've seen this become adversarial, where the forensic evidence is rolled out and then jurors listen to experts debate it. You were the defense expert, one of them, in the Casey Anthony case. Has so much of this adversarial presentation come into vogue because the evidence itself is so fallible, Barry?
No, well, there is a process, and it starts certainly at the bench in the crime laboratory, where you have to have people who are properly trained and qualified to do the examinations. You have to have a laboratory that has quality procedures in place to make sure that the tests are valid before they're applied to actual casework. You have to have a report that's clearly written and that doesn't overstate the findings of the examination. And all of that is managed through a process of accreditation and certification of scientists. You mentioned the issue in Boston with controlled substance analysis. Mm-hmm. Those tests were being performed in a laboratory that was not accredited. So when you put these processes in place, it significantly reduces the
possibility. But it was the state's laboratory. So, I mean, credited or not, it was doing the major work in all state.
Well, then there's an obligation on the part of the courts to make sure that they're acting as gatekeepers to ensure that the laboratories or the evidence that they're letting into their cases comes out of laboratories that at least have these minimum standards in place. And then in addition to that, every single case, whether it's from an accredited laboratory or not, needs to be scrutinized and questioned, and both sides, the limitations and strengths of it, presented to the jury. That's the beauty of the adversarial system.
Tom, may I?
Peter, yes.
Yeah, I mean, one of the problems with that model is that the adversary system doesn't work that way. Lawyers, like judges, are fundamentally scientifically illiterate. And we count on our experts for saying things that have already been determined to be demonstrably valid through the scientific method. We don't, question whether before we give one of our children a test for strep throat. We don't expect to cross-examine the analyst on a witness stand. Instead, we have confidence in the reliability of that product. What we're talking about here is also developing upstream controls and standards, making it more scientifically rigorous. Accreditation is at the end of all that. But before you have good people in the lab who are well-trained, you got to make sure that the actual assays they're using, the actual tests and hypotheses.
Work. Peter, we're up against a break. Peter Neufeld, Barry Logan, please stand by. We're talking about forensic evidence itself on trial. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking talking this hour about deep second thoughts on the reliability and accuracy of forensic evidence. The FBI now reviewing thousands of cases where it's nothing like as slam dunk as CSI, where thousands may have been wrongly convicted. We're looking at what works, what often doesn't, and what we do now. Barry Logan is with us from Philadelphia, president of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences. He was a defense expert in the Casey Anthony case, among many, many others. Peter Neufeld is with us from Washington, co-director of the Innocence Project. That's a nonprofit that tries to help innocent people wrongly imprisoned, convicted. Paul is calling from North Kingston, Rhode Island. Paul, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Couple of questions. Number one is, it's a fascinating discussion, but, you know, of these thousands of cases that are coming into question now, I just can't believe that they were all based solely on forensic evidence. There had to be some other supporting evidence for convictions. And secondly, you seem to emphasize, or it has been emphasized, that hair analysis is the, you know, sort of the forensic science that is coming into question.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't it be a relatively easy check to run DNA on these hair samples, assuming they still exist? To see if they were valid or not?
Those are both great questions. Different, but I'll put one to Peter and one to Barry. Peter, first on this issue of, over time, the relative weight of forensic evidence in achieving convictions. Paul's imagining that surely forensic evidence was just a piece of what has sent people to prison.
Paul's entirely correct. In most cases, no one piece of evidence alone is responsible for the conviction. But, Paul, you have to remember, in 75% of our wrongful conviction cases, there were misidentifications as well. In about 30% of the cases, there were false confessions. But there's no question that in 71 cases already where we've exonerated people with DNA, where we deconstructed those cases, in 71 of them, false or misleading hair testimony was an important contributing factor in those wrongful convictions.
So, and what about the so-called CSI effect that juries have become perhaps, you know, inappropriately heavily drawn to forensic evidence in their decisions?
We've had jurors say that, I don't want to even hear about the DNA. I was convinced by that hair expert. It was so certain.
Barry Logan, what about hair and DNA? Can we go back, pick up the hair, and do a DNA test on any and all of it now and know what the fact of the matter was or not?
Well, it is possible to do certain types of DNA testing on hair. And in fact, as the technology improves, some of the standard types of DNA testing have now been applied to recover DNA from the shaft of hair. So that is one way, in some cases, to go back and compare the hair examiner's opinion with modern technology and see to what extent that's validated.
Does all hair contain the same kind of DNA, or do you need to have some all the way down to the follicle to have the full DNA profile? How much of what hair contains what DNA, Barry?
Well, when DNA testing first started back in 2000, you would need a blood spot about the size of a quarter to get a DNA profile, whereas today we can get a DNA profile basically from somebody picking up a piece of paper or an object. And so we're now able to get the same kind of DNA out of the shaft of the hair. In the interim, there's been a technique called mitochondrial DNA, which doesn't give as firm an identification of an individual or an association. But that technique, and so that technique is widely used also for hair examination now. And in fact, it replaced microscopic identifications from hair back in the early 2000s.
So we recently had this again in Boston with the Boston Strangler case, a hair from a descendant picked up and used. Could they have had just any hair? Does it have to be all the way to the root?
I'm not specifically familiar with that re-examination. certainly if you have cells adhering to the root of the hair, it's a lot easier to do DNA testing than if you're just working with a portion of the shaft of the hair.
Peter Neufeld, what about hair in the age of DNA analysis? Is it more reliable? Can it be used as the, you know, the ultimate arbiter?
What, DNA?
DNA and DNA from hair in particular.
Oh, no. Yes, they can. They do DNA testing even without the hair follicle, without the root of the hair. The mitochondrial DNA testing that Barry Logan just mentioned is used all the time now. And in fact, the FBI has offered, which quite admirably has offered, to do free DNA testing in all these cases where the prosecutors request it or court orders it, in all these old hair cases. One statistic is very, very important, and also in response to Paul's question, which is in 2002, the FBI did a study where they looked at 88 recent cases where the best people in the FBI hair unit had determined that there was a hair match. And on those 88 cases, they did mitochondrial DNA testing. And when they did the DNA testing, it turned out that in 11% of the cases, they were wrong when they declared matches. There were actual exclusions. So you're right, DNA is much more dispositive. It can be used here. The problem we're going to have in a lot of these cases, unfortunately, is in the intervening 15 or 20 years, the hairs may no longer exist. They could have been destroyed. They could have been lost.
Barry Logan, here's a listener online home asking, saying, I absolutely cannot imagine looking at air and odor analysis. Cannot imagine that any expert could smell an automobile trunk mat. I guess this came up in the Casey Anthony case that you worked on, and confirmed that the odor was that of a dead human, as opposed to a dead cat or the wet landscaping manure that remained on some old boots or anything else. What about air and odor analysis, Barry?
Well, that's a great example of something that is a research technique. And who's to say that maybe 20 years from now we won't have a validated technique that would allow you to tell if a dead body had been stored in a vehicle trunk or in the basement of a house based on chemicals that were emitted by the body during the decomposition process. But in the Anthony case, the evidence that the state had didn't meet current forensic science standards. The laboratory wasn't an accredited laboratory. They didn't have a written procedure for the testing they were doing. They had no guidelines in terms of how they were going to interpret the results once they obtained them from the test. So in that case, it was my opinion that it was absolutely inappropriate and confusing evidence, I think, for the jury to hear.
But the prosecution was quite ready to use it.
They were, but in that case, the prosecution had actually talked to both to their state crime laboratory and to the FBI laboratory about that technology and were told that it wasn't something that either of those laboratories believed was a validated or reliable forensic technique, and they had to go outside of the forensic community to find somebody to do that test.
The FBI now reconsidering. How widely that reconsideration will go, we'll see. Let's go to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Elisa is calling. Hi, Elisa, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My question is this. Given the FBI's apparently new willingness to question the validity of their forensic practices, I'm interested to know how and if individual states will be held accountable for taking this new information into account when reviewing the validity of their previous cases.
Peter, let me bring that to you. The FBI is doing some soul-searching here. What about states? Will they be required to? Will they just blow it off? Will they wait and see?
Well, as Jack Nickus mentioned before, the American Society of Crime Lab Directors issued a memo back in April, which they sent out to all their state members of accredited laboratories, telling them that in light of the FBI review of hair, that they have an ethical duty to look at their own lab's work to see whether or not there were problems. In the last week alone, Texas has commenced a review of their state hair cases by their own examiners. The Tucson Crime Laboratory in Arizona has already announced that they, too, are going to conduct a review of hair cases. It's my expectation that there will be several dozen states that feel compelled to commence the same type of review of old hair cases that the FBI is currently doing nationwide.
Let me ask you here, a lawyer mama writes on our website. She says, no forensic lab should be part of any law enforcement department. They should be freestanding, independent agencies whose only mission is the facts. How does that line up with reality today, Peter?
Well, most labs are part of a law enforcement agency, and one of the recommendations that came out of the National Academy of Science report in 2009 was to avoid even the appearance of a conflict of interest. To demonstrate total neutrality and objectiveness, they should be separate. However, for fiscal reasons, a lot of the laboratories balked at that and said that that would be impossible. We've taken the position that although ideally it would be great if they were independent, nevertheless, they certainly could initiate quality assurance measures in the laboratories, even if they are under the wing of law enforcement, to enhance the independence and neutrality of the final result. And hopefully those kinds of changes are developing as well across the country.
But right now, that's not the way it tends to go. Catherine in Stoneham, Massachusetts. Catherine, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is the difference between, all right, here it is. Can amplification on touch DNA by a good defense attorney turn into enhanced DNA? I'm very interested in touch DNA.
Are you saying touch as in touch this, T-O-U-C-H, touch?
Touch this, yes.
Okay.
DNA, which is located on clothing generally.
Okay.
Forced contact, casual contact, particularly in a strangulation case I'm looking at. I'm wondering about two machines, the VMV 560 and the ABI 310.
Do you have, is there a particular case you have in mind, Catherine?
Yes, there actually is a particular case. It's my daughter's. It's 18 years unsolved. And it's all due to the fact of the lack of the evolution of DNA analysis. I'm her mom. It's frustrating, and I'm relentless. I won't give up. I'm always asking for more help.
I understand that. So, and you're asking about a strangulation case and wondering, Barry, if I may, Catherine, stick with us. Are there amplifications that could take DNA off of, a surface and permit it to be more deeply analyzed? How do you hear that question, Barry?
Sure. Well, I mean, DNA testing has certainly been used in exoneration, such as the cases that Peter's been discussing. But it's also now being applied to solving old cold cases. And as I said, the technology has evolved and it's become more sensitive. And there are now cases that will produce results that wouldn't have produced results with the testing we were using 10 or 15 years ago. So touch DNA is certainly applied in a lot of cases now. Clearly, the less material you have to work with, sometimes the lower the likelihood of getting a result from it. But there are police departments and investigating agencies and some private foundations around the country that are promoting getting some of these older unsolved cases worked using today's technology.
Catherine, it sounds like you're investing a lot of hope here in forensic evidence, DNA in particular. I want to be sure we get to the bottom of your question. Does that get toward it, Catherine?
Okay. My daughter, Deanna Kremen, was found strangled to death on March 30th, 1995. And via the local police department, the state department, I don't know if the FBI has been involved. What I do know is that when they have some DNA testing, they take it out of Massachusetts into Manhattan. We do not have the efficient machines, technology here in Massachusetts.
Yep.
And, this touch DNA has really grabbed my attention because I do not think this was a serial killer or somebody like that. I think this was actually a crime of passion, and it's a fluke that the technology has not caught up with the crime.
Catherine, we hear that hunger for it to catch up, and we hope it does for you, for some peace of mind and maybe justice. I appreciate your call. Let me get one more if I can. Evansville, thank you, Catherine. Evansville, Indiana. Vicki, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Tom, I have a child who is totally bought into the whole CSI occupation and is currently minoring in forensic science at a major university in Indiana. And I just want to know, is it kind of irresponsible of the universities to allow for a degree or even a minor in a subject that has this much controversy?
There's a parent's heartfelt question. Barry Logan, sure. I mean, you're the president of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, so I guess you have to say that it's a worthy field. But what about this controversy and what it means for a young person who might be studying forensic science now?
Well, I think there's a lot of risk of potentially throwing the baby out with the bathwater in terms of areas of forensic science where there are known issues, and the FBI has been very forthcoming in the area of hair comparisons and also bullet lead, which was mentioned in the newspaper article. But the way forensic science is practiced today, with accreditation of laboratories, and what that means is that you have to demonstrate that the methods you're using are free from contamination. They're not going to produce false positives on samples that don't contain the material you're looking for. The people are properly trained to do the testing.
Sure.
That there's external review, so people come inside your laboratory and inspect it. And,
overall, a worthwhile field for Vicky's child?
Yes, and forensic science programs. If somebody's looking for a career in forensic science, they should be looking for a forensic science program that's accredited by the forensic science education accreditation program.
Probably is it a major university?
You can find information about that on the American Academy of Forensic Sciences website.
Peter Neufeld, what do you say to this mother's question? I mean, it goes to the whole issue of the efficacy of forensic science. It also goes to the issue her daughter wants to get into the field. You got a lot of people in prison who might want to get out.
Well, I wouldn't dissuade her, but what I would say, and Barry Logan would agree, that now that the federal government has created a National Commission on Forensic Science, is putting millions of dollars into having the National Science Foundation do basic and applied research, and having a scientific agency, NIST, of the federal government, try and develop scientifically based standards for all crime laboratories across the country, I think we would both agree that in the future, there'll be much more opportunity in the field of forensic science for this woman's daughter.
Amazing questions raised here. We'll see where it all goes. Peter Neufeld at the Innocence Project, thank you very much for being with us. And Barry Logan, president of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, our thanks to you both. Tomorrow in this hour, we'll talk about Pope Francis in Brazil, the Pope of the Poor. Brazil dealing with some pretty rough stuff itself right now. Join us for that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.